Good evening, all. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I have a very special guest with me. He is an international best-selling author who has been highly awarded and highly acclaimed for his Jim Brody books. He is an antiques dealer and kind of a reluctant private investigator. But Barry Lancet, who writes the books, has been honored by Suspense Magazine. He won the Barry Award for Best First Mystery Novel, Best Book of the Year by Suspense, and several other mystery thriller roundups. He's got three books out right now. He was a finalist for the Seamus on his last book. I think you're going to really enjoy this show. Welcome to Authors on the Air, Barry Lancet. How are you this evening?
Fine. Thank you for having me, Pam.
I'm so glad that you're here. You know, we were talking before the show, and I said, I hate the fact sometimes that I'm booked so far ahead. Excuse me, because I don't get to speak to the authors when their books come out and when they win all the awards. But congratulations on all of the accolades you've received for your series.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's very nice. It also works out well for me because I happen to be on the West Coast instead of in Tokyo, which is where I usually am.
So we were talking about this. You are a very part-time resident here in the States, and you spend most of your time in Tokyo. And why did you originally go there?
You know, it was accidental. I basically took a left turn instead of a right turn. I was going to Europe, and then I ran into some people who said, well, if you're going to travel, why don't you come to Tokyo too? And I said as a joke, I still remember this to this day, I said as a joke, well, maybe I'll take the long way around to Europe. And then as it got closer to schedule my departure and stuff, I got a little bit intrigued in Japan. I knew absolutely nothing except for how to say thank you. And I just went on a fluke, and when I got there, it was so different from everything else I had ever seen, and something just clicked.
Tell me what you first noticed and felt that was so different when you arrived.
There were several things. The first was there was a certain vitality. There's just such an energy and a vitality, like you find in some big cities like, say, Manhattan. But there was no hard edge. It was vital. It was new. You're also instantly illiterate because everything is in characters, and that sort of puts a sort of buffer between you and the reality that's there. And so my immediate reaction was to try and get beyond that. And then there was the aesthetic, the way things were arranged, small and large buildings. And then you step into a restaurant, and there's just such wonderful little touches. And then the art also attracted me because it's got a completely different set of values when compared to Western art. And all those things sort of just grabbed me by the throat and never let go.
So this little vacation that you were taking ended up how long?
You know, I went for just... I went for, it's a while back now, I went for just about 2 or 3 weeks, and I ended up staying 2 months. So then I went to Europe, and then I went back just to make sure, I went back for about 5 or 6 months, explored things from shore to shore till they basically kicked me out. The immigration said, you know, our country's so small, you don't need to spend any more time here, and they threw me out, basically. So I went back, and I was leaving anyways. So I went back to school, graduated. I'd taken some time off of college, graduated, worked a little bit in the States, and something just called me back. I'd always had a dream to work overseas for a short spell.
May I assume you weren't writing books at that time?
You may. I wanted to. But my first thought was, well, until I didn't feel that I really had a subject. I wanted to write something, and I really had a strong desire to write something, but I knew I didn't have a subject. So my thought was, I'll work in publishing for a while. But I also wanted to travel and live overseas. I didn't want to stay in New York or California. So I thought, well, I'll go to London or Paris, where I thought I could probably get a pretty interesting publishing job. But when I circled around to Tokyo, it turned out there was a thriving little publishing industry in English language going on. Three very good quality mid-sized publishers, and about four or five very small ones. And their books were here in the States. I'd seen them, but whoever looks at a publisher when you see a book, you just sort of pick up a book. And and so I added them to my list of London and Paris, and in the end, that's where I ended up.
Interesting. Did you end up working for one of these publishers?
I ended up working for at one of the top three, some often the biggest publisher in Japan, in their English language division. It was actually a separate company, and I did for a number of years. I acquired and developed various books, mostly nonfiction, because I was poking around in fiction myself, so I stayed with the nonfiction, and that included art, sociology, Asian philosophy, some American art books, a lot of Japanese art books, and just about any subject you can mention related to Japan, and that sort of...
That was your education, wasn't it? That was your education.
It's exactly right. And it was my education, and it was my in to all these experts who took me behind the scenes and showed me all things most people, foreigners and Japanese alike, never get to see.
Really? How fascinating. What was your biggest surprise when you saw behind the scenes?
Well, there were quite a few. One of them was when I found, this was quite something I found by accident. I started digging into Japanese ceramic arts, which is probably on a very high level and are considered art pieces in themselves and go for tens of thousands of dollars, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And I found somebody who I thought was extremely talented, and he was working way out in the mountains of Nara, and it took me about a month or two to locate him and then arrange a visit. And when I went out there, he was this sort of like once in a lifetime, once in a generation type artist. And he had built his own house in the mountainsides, and he was working at such an astounding level. And pieces were just laying around. He'd make them and he'd stack them outside and leave them because he liked them to get a certain patina of age from the outdoors. And that was a big eye-opener. And he was working in a very, very traditional way in the 20th and now 21st century. But he was working in a way with a very keen eye and a modern sensibility that combined tradition and modern in just a very unique way. But his lifestyle was just sort of simple, and it could have been the 17th century.
So may I assume that part of Jim Brodey came from that experience?
I guess you could. Part of Jim Brodey came from my interest in sort of pursuing all these different aspects of arts and the high-end craft work done in Japan, certainly from that.
Hmm.
And it's something I sort of grew up with in California. We always had art and crafts, high-end stuff in the house, and so I was sort of attuned to it when I went there, but then everything was so very different again. So,
wow. What did you study when you went to college?
You know, by default, I started out as a pre-med simply because everybody said be pre-med, and so it was a lot of pressure, but I got very bored with it very quickly. So I changed to psychology, which was actually quite fascinating, but everything is so, shall we say, uncertain. And
mm-hmm.
in the end, I ended up as a literature major by default, I would say. The old saw that you don't really need to study English literature to write English books is very true. You know, what they say is you should study something else because you can learn all you want from reading good books, and I'm pretty much of that mind after having gone through the program.
You, Well, have you always been a reader? Do you recall always reading as a child?
Actually, not. I was not. I know so many people are. They start reading from a very young age. I read at a very early age for the first few years, and then, you know, like any boy who wanted to be outdoors, I was outdoors all the time playing sports and climbing mountains and getting into basically dirty, dusty trouble. And but somewhere in the last year of high school, first year of college again, I got very, very heavily into it again. And I really started reading deeply, mostly European stuff as opposed to American stuff, but German, French, Russian, British, and some American. And that started me wishing, started me thinking, well, I can, there's so much freedom and there's so many different voices and there's so many different ways that people write. That's where the germ came from. But and there were so many expat Americans writing in Europe, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, you know, the whole Henry Miller, Anais Nin, and Gertrude Stein, that whole group, and then the others, of course, Hemingway and all those people. So that sort of, and I had this unquenchable bug to travel and to live overseas, and all that stuff just sort of melded together.
Did you, when you were reading, did you read noir and pulp and mysteries and thriller, what we call thrillers now? Was that the genre generally that you liked to read in, or were you reading literature? You know, which is, when you say that, it kind of, it sounds kind of highbrow, but I think when, at least when I was younger, we didn't define books by genre. I think that's more of an Amazon thing. It happened to describe, and now there's a million subgenres. But do you remember what you were fascinated with when you read?
I just picked up, and one author led to another. So if they mentioned one or if there was a similar one, I read that way. It was not an organized plan. And so I wasn't genre sensitive, but I tended to read more contemporary literature or older literature. But when I started editing books, which is what I did in Japan, and you sit all day with these heavy manuscripts on your desk, you know, I still had this huge desire to read, and I'd read some crime and some noir, but, you know, it was evenly distributed among everything else. But I looked around at all the other editors there, and they were all reading crime and suspense, because it's well-written, crime and suspense, because it's somehow lighter and attentive, and it didn't clash with the manuscripts we were editing, which were very, you know, that's a reading process too all day. So you have to read something that occupies a different part of your mind. So that's how I got very much into it.
Mysteries and suspense and crime fiction are very flexible, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, you can do just about anything you want with them these days. And there's so many good writers.
There are so many. Speaking of, do you have any favorite writers from the past and perhaps current favorite writers that you'd like to mention?
Do I have any favorite writers? What was the first part?
From the past who are no longer living, and any contemporary writers that you'd like to read.
Well, if you're let's see. I mean, I loved Dostoevsky and Victor Hugo and Dumas. And now, if you think about it, my favorite books by them were actually, I think you could say, for example, Crime and Punishment, which is one of my all-time favorites, is basically, these days, it would be called maybe a psychological thriller. That's how it would be labeled.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And it's one of
I'm going to have to go to Amazon and look that up, you know.
And so the classics, I like that. I like the Les Miserables, which was, you know, the book, which is thousands of pages. But that was basically a thriller. Today, that would be an an international, you know, it's an international thriller is what they would label it.
Absolutely.
If that was to come out.
Absolutely.
So I tended to move in later days towards the more sort of the really sort of well-written crime and thriller type works. Although there were certainly plenty of others that I liked that I read.
Interesting.
Balzac and people like that.
So I want to just take a minute and remind everyone, Barry is generously offered to take calls. If you're interested in calling in, the number is 347-633-9609. I'm on Facebook at 4 Pound Stack. You can go ahead and DM me if you have a question, and I hope you're listening in. So now I want to know, when did you turn your eye to identifying your need to sit down and put pen to paper? When did you decide, I have an idea for a character and I'm going to write it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I had, as I said, during my college days, I had this sort of very strong desire to write that I couldn't ignore. But I did write some things, but for the most part, I realized I didn't have a subject yet that I was very comfortable writing about. So I wanted to get out in the world, and that's what I did. I got out and I traveled. And then I ended up settling in Japan. And then one day, when I got back to Japan and decided to stay for a few years, notice the few there. The few has turned into several decades now. But
right.
after a while, I said, well, you know, maybe I could write something about Japan. And I hadn't decided what. I knew I wanted to write fiction and not nonfiction. And that's as far as I went. And then one day, I came home from work, and I was working on a Saturday night. I still remember this, and I went out drinking with friends and colleagues afterwards, which is quite a common thing there. Well, it's a common thing in a lot of places. And I came home.
You're authors.
And,
it doesn't surprise me.
What's that?
It's a thing about authors. Go to any conference, and where do you go? The bar, right?
mm-hmm.
Funny. So you're out with colleagues, and?
We're out in colleagues. I come home, and when I get home, at the time I was living in central Tokyo, and I was married, and my wife was, I'm still married, and my wife was there. Her parents lived in the same building, but in a separate quarters. But she was downstairs with them, and when I came home, they were all standing in the middle of the room looking very red-faced. And it wasn't the red face of embarrassment. It was this sort of huge, bubbling anger. And I said, what's wrong? What happened? And they said, what did you do? I said, what do you mean, what did I do? I didn't do anything. And they said, yes, you did. The Japanese police called here. Well, the Tokyo Police Department just called here, and they want you to come down to the station tomorrow for a voluntary interview, and the voluntary being in quotes, of course. And what did you do? I said, I didn't do anything. And they said, you must have done something, because the Japanese police just don't call people's homes unless it's a really, you know, terrible offense. And I said, there's absolutely nothing I've done that I can think of, you know, maybe except for maybe drinking too much on occasion. And so that's how we left it. It was Saturday night, and on Sunday morning at 10 a.m., I went down to the police station, and a big police station. And when I got there, I told the desk officer my name. And at this time, I didn't speak any Japanese. Now I speak Japanese perfectly fine. But at this time, I didn't speak any Japanese because I'd only been there 14 months, right?
Okay.
And so, as I said, I had this idea to write a book, and I had this idea that I could do something on Japan. And when I got down there and told the desk sergeant who I was, you know, he yelled, he called somebody from the back room, and this big, burly, uniformed police officer comes out and growls at me something in Japanese, which I didn't understand, which I basically understood to mean follow me. And then he took me into the back rooms, down a corridor, left, right, and deep into the bowels of the station, and then threw me into an interrogation room. I mean, he opened the door, told me to go in, and then slammed the door and left me there for 45 minutes. I said,
oh my God,
this isn't good. Yeah.
No.
and, And I had no idea what was going on. I wasn't scared. I don't get scared very easily. I've been in a lot worse situations and have not gotten scared, but I was certainly not happy. And because I realized this kind of trouble, it had taken me 6 months to get a visa, do all the paperwork, and get approved to go to Japan and stay there and work. And they were very, very strict in those days. They're still strict, but they were much, much stricter during those days. And I thought, all that work's going to go down the tubes. You know, if I've done something that they consider offensive, I'm going to be declared persona non grata and thrown out of the country for no reason that I could tell. So 45 minutes pass, and the door opens, and in comes a very dignified detective, silver hair, suit and tie, immaculately. Of course, he's Japanese, so he's immaculately dressed, and the tie is perfectly knotted, and his shirt is starched. He comes and sits down. He smiles at me, sort of coolly, but he smiles, and then he starts to talk to me in English. Now, because I didn't know, he asked me if I spoke Japanese. I said no, and I mean, I was learning, and I knew some things, but not enough to handle this sort of thing. And his English is very good. Now, it was Sunday morning, and there aren't that many people, surprisingly, even to this day, that really speak good English in Japan, and certainly not among the police department. And so somehow they found, and he was a detective. They found a detective who could speak English on a Sunday morning, and that was this fellow. And he was very charming. He was very smart. He was very clever. And so because it was only him, he had the duty to sort of play kind of good cop, bad cop all in one. And that made this, and he began to question me. And it was this, it very quickly turned into this very sly cat and mouse game. And I realized that if I didn't answer the questions the way he wanted and the way that satisfied him, they were going to throw me out. And when I asked him, well, what am I doing here? He said, well, we'll get to that. And so I never got a direct answer for the next 3 hours. Well, he asked me about everything under the sun and everything about my travels, about my personal life, about my finances, about my girlfriend's past
my gosh,
in the States and elsewhere, everything. And you couldn't say, you know, I was getting, initially you get angry, right? You get angry and feel a little self-righteous, but at the same time I said, okay, this hasn't happened without a reason. I just don't know what it is. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, he was very, very clever, and he was so good at what he was doing, I kind of became fascinated with his technique. And I sort of so I got more interested in his technique and started taking notes mentally. And finished the interview, got through it, and managed to pass whatever test it was. And when I got out, that's when it suddenly struck me. I said, well, I wanted to write something about Japan. Maybe I can write some kind of detective mystery thriller sort of book. And I had two characters. I had the big, burly Japanese policeman who threw me in the room initially, and I had this very suave senior detective. And
did you ever figure out why they called you down there? Were you ever given a clue as to why you were?
At the very end, it was because I had neglected, it was a non-criminal offense. I had neglected when I renewed my visa after a year to go down to the local city hall and tell them I'd renewed my visa and the expiration date had changed. Apparently you had to do that. Nobody told me, and if it was on a piece of paper they gave me, I didn't see it. But that gave them the right to sort of haul me in and, you know, put me through the ringer and decide if I was, you know, desirable or undesirable. But and that's kind of how it started.
Wow. That's a fascinating story, though, and I have to tell you, you kept your cool, and you know, this became part of your story. But geez, I would have been a nervous wreck, I have to tell you. Because you're right. I guess, you know, they don't even have to give you a reason why they say, okay, we no longer want you here. And obviously that's not something you wanted to happen. So you have now two characters, and you have a love mm-hmm. of fine art, and you have a love of aesthetic and of the culture and so on. So you began to do what? You had a storyline, did you have a what if moment? You've had characters, but did you have a story to put those characters with?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to do an international thriller with a strong mystery bit and noir, but a sort of forward-looking noir, not really too dark and gloomy. I wanted all the positive aspects of noir, but not the dark and gloomy, more sort of the way Robert B. Parker does it, in the sense he's looking, you know, a very modern take on it. And so I did that, but I took it international. And I wanted to give, so Brody had to have that sort of, Jim Brody had to have this sort of street smarts. But I also wanted to be able to talk about Japan and everything I was seeing in Asia. And because of my job, I got to see all kinds of things that most people don't see. And after now, it's been over two decades, I kind of can identify with, I don't know if you ever remember the movie Blade Runner. It was there's this last scene, which is I think kind of famous now, but where Harrison Ford, who plays this sort of sci-fi detective, he catches up with the last replicant, the last criminal he's supposed to be hunting down, and actually just before the robot dies, he says, "I've seen things that you people have never seen." And I can really identify with that now, having been there so long and done so many different things. And that's what I wanted in this series, in a sort of very fast-paced mystery thriller way. Those are the kind of things I wanted to introduce in the context of a thriller and mystery story. So because of that, and because of Japan and certain parts of Asia, I needed Brody to not only be street smart and tough, but I wanted him to be able to talk about the culture and the history and the art or whatever, those kind of aspects, which is what often brings people to Asia and specifically to Japan. Quite often they come to see those things, you know, whether it's a Zen garden or, you know, the architecture or some sort of Zen temple, or there's any number of things, right? Karate, judo, all these things. And so in order for him to do that, I gave him a background where he's an American born to American, Caucasian American parents in Japan. And his father was in the military. His mother had gone to Japan as a Red Cross volunteer, but she was an art curator by trade. So when his father musters out of the military after being an officer and an MP, he opens his own private practice in Japan. And so Brody learns sort of both sides. I mean, his mother's always pulling him towards the finer things, and his father's always is already training him for the sort of down and dirty, rough and tumble stuff of his field. And the story's open when Brody is now 31 and living back in California with all this background, and he is in San Francisco trying to get an art shop, an antique shop off the ground. But he's also, because he's a Japan expert now, one of the few around, he's a consultant for the San Francisco Police Department, where he's got friends. And
this
what
is
if,
the first book, Japantown, correct?
Yeah, that's the background for all the books, but this is the first book. The first book opens in San Francisco, Japantown. It's called Japantown.
Right.
And The what if there is, it opens with the perfect murder in San Francisco, Japantown, with one clue that nobody can read, and that clue is a Japanese character at the murder site in a pool of blood written on a bit of handmade Japanese paper. And then, so Brody's called to the scene as a consultant, and he looks at the character and he says, I've seen that only once before, because he is fluent in Japanese, right? I've seen that only once before, and it doesn't exist. That's how it starts. So
I like, you know, everyone who's listening, please go to barrylancet.com /books so that you'll get a little snippet of information. And also on Barry's website, there is a very nice description and a little monologue by Jim Brody. And I think you'll really enjoy it. Very, very nice. Very nice. I like it very much, as a matter of fact. This book draws incredibly rave reviews. You've gotten all kinds of nominations and awards for Japantown, and you decide then that you're really enjoying it. Jim Brody's a well-established character, so you write Tokyo Kill. And mm-hmm. The one thing I have to tell you, your book jackets are beautiful. I don't know who has designed them for you, whether it's your publisher, if you have a graphic artist or not, but the books are lovely. They just really are beautiful. So Tokyo Kill is book number 2. So we
That's right.
still find – and I just want to say that let me tell you that this book was so well reviewed by Washington Independent Review of Books, the Library Journal, Kirkus, Science Thriller. There is best-selling crimethrillers.com, bibliophilesreverie.com. There are so many, many people, Forbes, Book Reporter, Steve Barry, who is a terrific writer himself, been on the show a few times, you know, number one bestseller, Fresh Fiction, Minneapolis Star Tribune, Booklist. Everybody is commenting about your books now. So Tokyo Kill comes out, and this is book number 2 with art dealer or antique dealer. You call him a reluctant PI, Jim Brody. What happens in this book?
Okay. He's just finished, a few months earlier, he's just finished up Japantown. Now, the other thing you need to know about Brody is that he's a widower. He has a daughter. He was married. His wife dies in an accidental fire with complications. That's sort of the story for that comes out in Japantown. But that's incidental. So after Japantown, he goes to Japan with his daughter for vacation. And he doesn't want to do any work, but he stops in at Brody Security, which is the security agency, the detective security agency that his father started 40 years ago, and half of which Brody inherited when his father passed away. So his heart is in the antiques business and the art business that he has back in California and San Francisco, but he feels a kind of obligation to keep his father's baby alive. And so he's a nominal head of that. And so he stops in to say hello and see how things are going. But he wants to, you know, spend time with his daughter, get back to the art, which is the thing he loves. And while he's there, in comes a 96-year-old Japanese World War II veteran who is looking just for Brody because he's read about the things that happened in Japan, in the Japantown case, and he wants Brody's mm-hmm. help. And he's on vacation, so he's very reluctant, but the this all happens in the first chapter, so there's no spoilers here. The vet tells him that he believes, he's 96 years old, he believes that somebody is killing off his old army buddies in Tokyo one by one, and he thinks it's the Chinese triads. There are Chinese triads, you know, mafia, Chinese
right.
gangs in Tokyo
right.
as well. And since he's 96, Japanese police don't believe him. They think he's senile, and he has nowhere else to go. and Brody is sort of charmed by the guy. He's pulled his best suit out of mothballs to come in to visit, and he initially tells Brody he's only 93, but his son who's with him there calls him on and says, "You're really 96, stop lying." He says, "I'm not lying, I just have to appear younger because in order to impress the ladies." And
it's so funny. You know, 96, 93. I love that. It's a great
So Brody's charmed. Exactly.
I love that.
So Brody's charmed by the guy, and he agrees to help. What's that?
It's just a great little trait for a character. You know, it gives him, it's another dimension to a character that I don't think I've ever heard before, and I really like that a lot. It's just a nice little twist. Small as it is, but it made a decision for Brody, and so, you know, well done, sir, well done.
Well, thank you. That's exactly right. So he puts his vacation on hold for a day or two, what he thinks is only going to be a day or two. But things turn nasty very quickly in very unexpected ways, and they draw him irretrievably into the case. And he has to send his daughter home to stay with friends, and he has to dig in. And very soon he's in danger himself. And then it goes through a whole panorama of things from World War II secrets to martial arts to lost art to spies and several murders and the case takes him, you know, throughout Japan and then other places as well, back to the US, Miami for one place, San Francisco, Miami, and then other places before he's able to solve the case. So it is really truly a kind of international murder.
International,
thriller.
For sure. Now I know this year Pacific Burn came out. This is the third book in this series for Jim Brody. Again, mm-hmm. fantastic reviews from everyone. I think that Steve Barry wrote a really nice piece about this, and he did an interview with you, correct? So
that's right. Yeah.
And I want to say that I love this because Kirkus says, as ever, Lancet stages some of the best, some good fight scenes. No one gets beaten up quite as well as Brody and keeps the action going. I love that. You know, so Brody's not a badass, or maybe he thinks he is, or maybe he knows he's not. I don't know. And so he's always getting his butt kicked, which is kind of funny. Another little interesting character trait that is a little bit interesting for a guy who is a private investigator and the nature of the things that he's investigating. So I was tickled when I read that. So tell us about book number three.
Book number three takes place. Brody is back in San Francisco. He's always been struggling. He's a widower trying to raise a young daughter, and he has two occupations. He has his antique shop, and he has the Brody Security Agency in Tokyo that he has to keep a hand in. So he's always traveling back and forth, and he's got two occupations plus a daughter. And sometimes he thinks, you know, as much as he loves a daughter, she's almost a third occupation because he's a single father. And so he's always extremely busy. And as this story opens, because of the work he did in Japantown, the mayor's helped the city of San Francisco, the mayor's tagged him to help with a new Pacific Rim friendship program that he's starting with six Asian countries. It's a cultural and business exchange, and it's a cultural exchange officially, and it's to create sort of better friendship and better commerce between, you know, San Francisco and the Pacific Rim. So Brody's
right.
brought on for the Japan liaison to help, you know, schedule an exchange of events. Art is coming from Kyoto in Japan for a big show in San Francisco, and then San Francisco and Northern California art is going to Japan for a big show there. And Brody's brought in a friend and famous Japanese artist to help arrange things on the Japanese side with him. And so they've just had a big meeting with the mayor all's going well. It seems to be going well. And what this means for Brody is if this goes well, he's suddenly, maybe with luck, this will take him up a step. And he, instead of this, maybe he'll move from struggling antiques dealer, barely able to make ends meet, to you know, the next level where he's gotten, he gets more attention and better clients. And so it's all going well for the city and him and his Japanese art friend. And they come out of City Hall after a very good meeting with the city officials, and there's a sniper across the way on the Asian Art Museum. Where else could it be? He shoots at them, and Brody barely gets away. His friend, his Japanese artist friend, is injured and goes into a coma, and so he's stuck in. And then Brody figures out very quickly. Again, this all happens in the beginning, so there aren't many spoilers. Very quickly that something odd is going on, and because his artist friend's son was killed mysteriously in Napa, wine country, a few chapters earlier, under very strange situation. And so he realizes that his friend is he thinks his friend's family might be targeted, or his friend, or it could be something to discredit the mayor's international friendship program.
I see.
Or it could be a political attack on the political side. He doesn't know what it is. There's so many possibilities. There's too many suspects and too many places to check. But it very quickly embroils him in danger. And
a new mystery. You know, Barry, listening to you describe the books, I like the fact that you start off with the big bang. You don't ease anybody into it. You start off, Brody hits the ground running almost literally from the first page. And I think that's real important, right? And I think that's really important for readers. We have a lot of choices. You know, a million books a year come out and they're thrown up on Amazon or Kindle or any other place where books are sold. And you have to catch your reader immediately. And, you know, I kind of jokingly was telling you, I get anywhere from 25 to 50 books a week from a variety of sources, whether it's publicists or authors or traditional houses or indies or, you know, small press, whatever it happens to be. And while I love to read and I want to give everyone a chance, because I'm time limited and I have so much product in front of me, my feeling is if you don't have me in the first couple of pages, I gotta put the book down and go on. And the sad thing is I can never go back. I don't ever get a chance to go back, because to me lately, in the past few years, I have seen better books than I've ever seen in my life. I'm reading more exciting books, different stories with different challenges and so on. So you really nailed it by throwing him under the bus pretty much from page one. That grabbed my attention immediately. And I would think that it grabs readers, as other readers as well. At least I hope it does, because it's a really good way to write a book. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, what was your question?
Well, I think that another thing I noticed is that you have a lot of different stories that may or may not be connected. And so for this style of book, for an international thriller like this, I like that. I like to know that I have to work for it, in other words, read. I have to work for it to unravel the mystery. And most times, I mean, I'm pretty good at reading these things. This is the genre I read the most. But I have to tell you that I get tripped up an awful lot. There's so much fantastic writing out there, and yours included. Congratulations on all your successes. I hope that – what is the next – when is your next book due out? Number four is due when? When do you hope it to be out, I should say?
Probably late spring, early summer. It's nearly done, and I'm just refining it now, which is the part I enjoy the most, because it's when you get to really put in the good storytelling.
Tighten it up. Right, right, right.
And,
what do you have a tentative name for your book?
I do, and it's a great title, but I've been told not to let it out yet.
Not to.
I'm really sorry.
No exclusives
the one thing,
here, then. I'll just have to
well,
have you come back.
I will
back.
Tell you this. Okay. I'll tell you this. It is not like the other three books. It is not a two-word title. I can tell you that much.
Interesting. Do you plan to keep Brody as your series character for a while, or do you have a desire to write a standalone, completely devoid of Brody?
Well, that's a good question. I've arranged it so that Brody can cover so much ground. For example, Pacific Burn, the third one, whenever I introduce some sort of the cultural, historical elements, whatever, it's always part of the story. It's never just thrown in sort of gratuitously.
Sure.
But
sure.
In Pacific Berm, each of the story has a list of 8 or 10 things that are in there. But for example, in Pacific Berm, there's, he goes to Kyoto for the first time, the old ancient capital, 1,200 years old. There's a scene, there's a sequence at a fugu restaurant, which is the poison blowfish.
Right.
There's Zen tea bowls, cosplay. There's the manga museum. I threw in some kind of Japanese pop culture, too, along with the traditional stuff.
Sure.
There's a giant bamboo forest on the edge of Kyoto, and there's all these things that become part of the plot. And because there's so much still that I want to explore, for the moment I'm going to stay with Brody. I've already got another three. Well, I've got about 6 or 7 ideas, but 3 that I really want to do at the moment. The one I'm working on.
How wonderful. Any desire ever to write outside the genre you're writing in right now?
I've been asked, and I've had actually publishers go to my agent, and they've been asking for material.
Interesting.
And so I'm thinking about it, but I'm having so much fun with this. I'm in no rush at the moment.
There you go. But if you're enjoying yourself, then you have to stay with it for sure. We're running out of time very quickly here, and I thank you for staying with me for so long. Sometimes I try to do 5 quick questions and 5 quick answers. Are you game to play?
Sure.
Called Final 5
or something.
Do I have to give you
an answer, or can I just listen?
Yes, absolutely, and it's a real quick one. Okay. All right. So
okay.
You've done an extensive amount of traveling, but I'm assuming you still have a bucking on your bucket list.
I want to get to Tibet still. It's not that far away from where I am in Japan, but I have yet to get there. And there's some very, very isolated places up in the mountains in China I'd also like to get to. I want to get to the Amazon. I'm fascinated with the river. And that's 3.
So traveling
so that,
is still high on your list.
That
well,
yes.
That's okay. That's great. So travel is still on your list. What have you figured out about your writing from when you wrote your first book to now when you're writing your fourth book? What kind of a storyteller are you compared to the first book and the fourth book?
I'm fascinated by the sort of art of storytelling and how it changes over the years and over the decades and over the years as the readers change and our interests change and our attention span changes. And so
yeah.
I'm always writing with that in mind, and I always want to keep myself entertained. I'm kind of my toughest reader in a sense. Having been a book editor for a number of years, I may have a I'm able to look at it from the editorial side as well. And so I always, it's a storytelling, I always want to jack it up another level. And what you mentioned just recently about something has to grab you quickly
yes.
and hold your attention.
Yeah.
I want to do that in a new way each time, and I want the first sentence to be great, the first paragraph to be great, the first chapter, and the first 50 pages. That's kind of and then the rest of the book too has to follow that. But that's
right. Kind
of where.
But you've
got
to get it in the beginning. Sure.
Yeah.
Are there any books that you have read more than once? And if so, tell me one of them.
Crime and Punishment, Gorky Park. Yeah, he did such a great job of
amazing
of
book.
Capturing that culture. You know, both mostly he does the down and dirty, but he does such a great job.
Right.
I don't know how he does it. So
amazing thing.
And several others. Yeah.
Any particular inspiration for writing? Anyone? Anything? I know that your police was a motivator, but were you inspired by anyone in particular?
You mean any? It was more the sort of collective experiences that I've had over the years, and wanting to show those to people. You know, so the book can be, you know, armchair travel as well, although it never. It's always embedded in the plot itself, so it keeps moving forward.
When people ask you what do you tell them you're an author or a writer, and why? Interesting, huh?
You know, I've never made up my mind which is better to use, so I sort of, I'm 50-50. If I mention it at all, I usually say, I write books, is what I say.
There
and,
you go.
And then if they say what kind,
well,
I don't.
Well, guests always tell me the same thing. My author guests always say, author sounds too big. I am a writer, and that's how they like to describe it. And to me, I just say author. I think it's wonderful. You know, I'm proud to know so many authors. Because I think that there are a lot of writers who are not authors, and vice versa. You know, I love the fact that I think you've earned the title. You know, when people ask what I do, I say I talk on the radio. And they say, oh, you're a journalist. I said, no, I'm a radio talk show host, you know. So I can never say journalist. So I understand the feeling. Oh, Barry Lancet, it has been a joy talking to you. I wish that we had more time. I've taken up so much of yours already. Will you come back and visit me again when the fourth book is out? Pardon me?
Yeah, I'd love to. It would be great. I enjoyed this
quite
a bit. I'd love to come back. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I've had just a magnificent time talking to you. And again, my apologies that it took so long to get you here. I want to remind everyone on Friday, Steve Conkley and Tom Abrams will be talking to each other. So it's an author-to-author conversation. I just sit in the background and listen. How nice is that? Barry Lancet, tell us where we can find you on the internet, please.
You can find me at barrylancet.com. Lancet is the last name. And on Twitter, and I've got two things on Facebook, a personal conversational one and a book page. And if you drop a line there, I will get back to you.
He actually does, folks. This is a man who answers his own mail. I love it. Barry, thank you again. I hope you have a wonderful stay in California. And then, of course, I hope you have fun at BoucherCon, too. I'm sorry I'm missing you then. Have a great evening.
Yeah, I shall be there, and it'll be a lot of fun. And, yeah, I'm sorry you're going to miss this one, but there's always the
Me
next
too.
One.
Me too.
So thanks
there will
again
be
for
others.
Everything.
That's right.
It's
Toronto, and then in Toronto next year, and then Florida the following year, and you can be sure I'll be at the one in Florida. Have a great evening. Thank you so much, Barry. Good night.
Okay. Thank you, Pam. Good night.
Sure thing. And that's our show for tonight, everyone. Thank you so much for staying with me. Have a lovely evening, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night. Thank you.